mindset that applies to healing? Can you stand above day-to-day events and hold on to an all-embracing vision that applies to life itself? The most successful vision that fits the bill is evolution, a theory that accounts for every life form from one-celled microorganisms and blue-green algae, both billions of years old, to a baby born in a hospital, to you reading this sentence. If you can evolve personally throughout your lifespan, you will have secured an all-embracing vision. Today, our recommendations focus on your personal growth / evolution and how to maximize it. To begin with, set aside Darwinian evolution, which is confined to the survival and non-survival of species, which means very large groups. Darwinism explains why the saber-toothed tiger emerged from primitive ancestors and finally declined until it became extinct. But Darwinism doesn't tell us anything about a single saber-toothed tiger as an individual. This is because survival and extinction are ruled by genetic mutations that spread throughout a plant or animal population. If the mutation leads to a survival advantage, it becomes embedded in that species. Human beings long ago escaped this setup. Instead of only the physically strong surviving, we take care of the weak through healthcare plans and retirement payments, for example. And competing for a mate isn't through physical combat. A poet has as much chance to win a loved one's hand as a weightlifter. There are many arguments over how and why Homo sapiens evolved, which we won't enter into here. A whole section of our book, Supergenes, covers the territory. For the purposes of healing, only one point proves critical: the personal evolution of the individual. Evolution for an individual is happening now. We've already offered one validation of this point in epigenetics, which has shown how experiences over a lifetime imprint markers that affect gene activity. Some researchers even hold that epigenetic markers from the mother or father can set their baby's view of how life works, which we described earlier. These clues point in the right direction, and so does the evolution of the human brain. Traditionally, the brain is viewed as divided into three parts, from the oldest to the most recent. One can visualize the tripartite brain as being like the staff of an English manor house, which in this case houses the mind. The manor perpetually buzzes with activity, and each of us is the lord or lady overseeing the servants who correspond to every region of the brain. Downstairs bustles the oldest brain, the reptilian or lower brain, which is nearly half a billion years old. It is organized around survival instincts like fight or flight, the urge to mate, and so on, instincts that first emerged in fish and primitive reptiles. Halfway upstairs is the limbic system, which is organized around emotions and bonding. It arose as long ago as 250 million years with the first mammals, who, so far as we know, are capable of something resembling human emotions. For example, elephants grieve over their dead, and porpoises come to the aid of their sick and injured. Somehow, the limbic system acquired the ability to remember pleasurable and painful experiences. And from there arose our desire to repeat the pleasurable ones and avoid the painful ones. At the top landing of the stairs is the most recent brain region, the cortex, where the elite servants wait on the lord and lady of the manor. Everything we think about and decide is managed here. The cortex surrounds the brain like the bark of a tree. Cortex is Latin for bark. When you are deep in thought, your brow furrows, and strangely enough, furrows, crevices, and grooves turned Homo sapiens, into thinkers. The cortex in rats and mice is smooth. In cats, the surface becomes irregular, and grooves start to appear in primates. Evolved species like higher primates and dolphins have deeper, more complicated grooves. But nothing surpasses the biological origami of the cerebral cortex in humans, which is folded into an intricate map that corresponds to the richness of our mental activity. Language, music, and art occur here. Shakespeare and Mozart are literally groovy. We argue that the real you is none of the activities in these brain regions. The real you is the lord and lady of the manor who observe these activities, every feeling, thought, and fancy of the mind. What links the higher brain to personal evolution is quite unique and yet mysterious. It's the ability to be self-aware. Self-awareness spans the immense territory between who am I and this is the real me, between self-doubt and self-mastery. Humans experience a bewildering range of self-generated images as we look in the mirror. Seeing ourselves, we can adopt a wide range of psychological profiles, including the following: self-satisfied, egotistical, selfish, and blind to our own faults. Self-doubting, humble, altruistic, and keenly aware of our shortcomings. Introverted, reflective, contemplative, and private. Extroverted, aggressive, competitive, and gregarious. These qualities exist in mix-and-match fashion, and for each trait, there are polar extremes. So many possibilities exist, in fact, that one could assign a unique profile to everyone on Earth. Without self-awareness, we betray our uniqueness and fall into stereotypes and conformity. Habit and conditioning overtake mindfulness. Going along to get along becomes second nature. If these external forces gain the upper hand, a person can live life by rote, existing more or less as a biological robot. Because we are self-aware, human beings do not simply live. We also watch our lives unfold. It's not possible to get into the nervous system of a humpback whale, giraffe, or panda, but in some way, these creatures have their own species of consciousness. It's not simply the physical resemblance that makes tigers and lions members of the same family, as a house cat prowling for sparrows on the lawn. They are linked by behavior, and this behavior goes back to how cats perceive the world. They are hunters, prowlers, capable of stealth, patiently crouching before they pounce, and so on. Today's recommendations revolve around exploring your unique participation in the human species of consciousness. That's a high-flown phrase, we know. But when all is said and done, planet Earth will thrive or decline depending on one thing: whether human consciousness can evolve. If it can, global warming can be stabilized and perhaps reversed. If human consciousness doesn't evolve, inertia will lead us into deeper risk of calamity. The do side. To evolve, you need to get into the habit of noticing where a new perspective goes beyond what you're already used to. Today's do recommendations involve just such shifts. Once you free yourself from your accustomed viewpoint, entirely new levels of awareness become possible. At this moment, everyone is living out a story in their heads. A good day adds something positive to the story. A bad day slightly undermines the story. The ups and downs of daily life depend on the themes of your story, such as winning versus losing, loving versus hating, leading versus following, and so on. The themes we live by are well known and fairly standard because we absorb them from our family, friends, and society. How your personal story keeps going. The themes you reinforce every day. Mindful or mindless? Optimistic or pessimistic? Winning or losing? Thriving or struggling? Active or passive? Doer or thinker? Loner or gregarious? Leader or follower? Vigilant or relaxed? Accepting or challenging? Giving or taking? Supporting or dependent? Loving or not loving? Attractive or unattractive? Helping or hindering? Hungry or satisfied? Seeking or holding tight? Progress or inertia? Confident or timid? Decisive or indecisive? Life is led by reinforcing both positive and negative themes, because they lend structure to a person's story. Without themes, the story would turn shapeless. Yet positive and negative themes share the same flaw. They bind you inside your story. It's better to win than to lose, for example. But if we heed the world's wisdom traditions, winning and losing are opposites that depend on each other. Therefore, winners will always eventually face loss. Optimism will eventually fail. Loving will eventually lead to disappointment. Evolution occurs when you stop identifying with these themes, known as the state of duality, and begin to measure your life in ways that are not dual, not dependent on opposites. What we're talking about are the fundamental qualities of consciousness that lie deeper in our awareness. The core qualities of consciousness. Intelligent, creative, self-aware, self-sustaining, alive, dynamic, evolutionary, self-organizing, knowing, compassionate, truthful, beautiful. Human beings can consciously evolve by discovering that these qualities are real and attainable. That's what the DO recommendations set out to demonstrate. If you align yourself with any of these qualities, we've just suggested a handful on the DO side, you will be directing your own personal evolution. But this must be more than an ego choice, because ego choices are based on duality. The ego's reason for being truthful instead of lying is that it gains a benefit or avoids a risk. What's in it for me? Is the basic ego question. The core qualities of consciousness transcend personal identity. They apply to mind itself, the pure essence of being alive and possessing awareness. Today, you can decide to build your story on these primal themes instead of the ones most people accept and live by. Dualism is insecure. What is given can be taken away. The thing you most desire can wind up being a disappointment. Likes change to dislikes and vice versa. Some people have exaggerated, even one-dimensional stories like, I'm a winner. Or, I'm a cockeyed optimist. But one way or another, people base their stories on themes that are constructs to which we attach ourselves. Today, we are asking you to take a higher view, to watch yourself as you keep living the same story. Only then can you make a choice that bases your story on permanent, unshakable values, like acting out of compassion or expressing love and appreciation. To really be transformed, your story must evolve, and your story can't evolve unless your consciousness evolves. The undo side. Everyone believes their own story, even when it's divorced from reality. Think of fashion models who are insecure because in their own minds, they aren't attractive enough. Their self-esteem is rocked by a pimple or the first wrinkle. Think of a professional baseball player on a dismally losing team who still feels like a winner. Winning is what got him into the major leagues to begin with. We hold on to our stories for emotional reasons. Therefore, the undo recommendations for today are all about getting free of emotional bonds. The bonds that keep us feeling insecure, unsafe, anxious, pessimistic, frustrated, and unfulfilled are blocking our evolution. A useful concept here is the emotional body. It includes the ingrained emotions that sustain you the same way your cells support the physical body. In their emotional bodies, one person may include feeling loved, safe, secure, and optimistic, while another person feels the opposite. If you try to improve your story, the ideal is to base it on the core qualities of consciousness we've just discussed. But this can't happen if your emotional body is wounded. There is simply too great a gap. Your emotional body can be healed. Undoing the wounds you have suffered from the past is a viable process anyone can undertake. The symptoms are easy to spot. Any strong negative thought that repeats itself is a symptom of pain in your emotional body. Let's look at a few of the best and easiest techniques for dispelling negative thoughts from the emotional body. 1. Catch your negativity early. Once you are sunk deep in gloom or anxiety, it's more likely that you will find it hard to lift yourself up. So be on the lookout for the first signs of negativity. As soon as you spot a mood shift toward irritability, anger, frustration, worry, or pessimism, pause immediately. Take a few deep breaths, center yourself. Let the emotion pass, and get yourself somewhere quiet and pleasant, such as going outdoors for a walk. 2. Avoid external stressors. Dark thoughts usually occur under stress, and if you can, you should get away from the stressor, whether it's a negative person, a tense situation at work, or bad news on TV. Dark thoughts set in when they are reinforced, so don't let anyone or anything reinforce your bad mood if you have the choice to avoid it. 3. Develop a supportive inner dialogue. About 75 to 80% of people talk to themselves in their heads, and a small minority even hear inner conversations. When the voice in your head starts saying things that induce worry, fear, anger, guilt, shame, or lack of self-esteem, pause for a moment and say to the voice, "That's not me anymore." Repeat until the dark thoughts depart. You might also try, "I don't need this anymore. It doesn't serve me." 4. Keep company with positive, optimistic people. We all have friends and family members who are downers. They are pessimistic or complaining. They insist on seeing worst-case scenarios and failure around the next bend. Inertia keeps us from walking away from these people. And sometimes you're stuck in situations you can't escape. But you can cultivate friendships with positive, optimistic people. Sociological studies have shown that you are more likely to adopt positive attitudes and behavior if you keep company with friends who already display them. 5. Try a thought replacement strategy. A technique that lies at the heart of cognitive therapy, an approach that addresses thoughts and beliefs rather than feelings, is to question negative thoughts by asking if they are actually true. For example, if you begin to feel frustrated and think, "What's the use? Things never work out," these thoughts are tested against reality. You say to yourself, "Actually, things sometimes do work out for me. I have succeeded by persevering. This might be one of those situations." The secret here is to be specific and honest with yourself. When any negative thought arises, challenge that thought's validity. Instead of "no one loves me," you replace that thought with "my mother loves me, and my good friends do too. I'm not helping myself by exaggeration and self-pity." Once you get accustomed to a thought replacement approach, you'll be amazed at its effectiveness. Moods follow thoughts, which is why discovering that your bank account is bigger than you thought makes you cheerful, while discovering that your credit card balance is twice as high as you thought makes you feel uneasy. 6. Develop being centered and detached. Being detached can be a positive state. It's not the same as being indifferent or bored. Instead, you are centered inside yourself, which allows you to view situations as a witness without being swayed or emotionally rattled. Detachment develops naturally through the regular practice of meditation. Because once you experience the centered, quiet, unshakable level of your mind, you easily learn how to return there at will. 7. Get sticky emotions to move. As we've been saying, negative feelings have a mind-body connection, which you can feel physically. After a bout of getting angry or crying, it takes a while before your body settles down. This is due to various hormones, the stress response, and other biochemicals that do not clear immediately. You can help the clearing process by various means: taking deep, steady breaths, lying down and resting, walking outside, toning, the technique of letting spontaneous sounds arise as they will, low groans, moans, shouts, etc. Deep, repeated sighs. Everyone needs to have a set of coping skills, and these are among the most useful and effective. Heavy thoughts don't have to cloud your day. You have good choices for how to lift yourself out of them. The highest evolution. Millions of people have stepped onto the spiritual path over the past few decades. The steady decline in organized religion, which began early in the post-war era, doesn't mean that the present generation is less spiritual. Spirituality is about going beyond the union of body and mind to the union of body, mind, and soul. When people step onto the spiritual path, they want to know how it will change them, how their life will improve, whether the dark side of their inner life will be filled with light, and so on. We haven't discussed these questions very much in this book for pragmatic reasons. Rudy and Deepak both accept the existence of soul, spirit, higher consciousness, and cosmic mind. But those are contentious terms founded on controversial beliefs. Because they are human constructs, there is no guarantee that any of them are more than constructs. What about transcendence, which is the experience of a domain beyond duality? To be practical, we've left spirituality out of the discussion. But spirituality cannot be divorced from reality. Every experience is known through the body-mind, including the highest spiritual experiences. The person who feels the presence of the divine is doing so through the same nervous system that we all possess. Therefore, a healing lifestyle that brings body and mind together opens a portal to infinite possibilities. Human evolution, having incorporated survival, emotional bonding, and reason, still has new horizons to cross. The highest state of evolution has only one requirement, self-awareness, which the higher brain already expresses. There are many ways to describe the highest stage of evolution. Union with the soul, the state of grace, union with God, salvation, Satori, going to heaven. The most ancient term, dating back thousands of years in India, is enlightenment. Yet any terminology begs the question of what it feels like to reach this highest state. The peculiarity of the spiritual path is that you don't know where you are going when you start out. This is why the Indian tradition speaks of the pathless path. The goal keeps shifting and blurring or even vanishing. In our view, the unpredictability of the path is inescapable. The self who took the first step isn't the self who arrives at the goal. In everyday life, this fact already holds true. The self you had as an infant, kindergartner, school child, and adolescent has vanished. So it should not be disturbing if the self you identify with today also morphs into something new by evolving. Despite the burdens of the past, with its old wounds and bad memories, we are designed for renewal at every level of the body-mind. New thoughts and new cells constantly replace the old ones. For all that, there is a measure of what it's like to reach the highest state of evolution. You feel, once and for all, like yourself. You get to be. In a detached yet passionate manner, you can observe your instincts, fears, desires, and random thoughts as they arise and fall in your mind. When you can do this naturally, you no longer get stuck in the mind's ceaseless activity as it churns through thoughts, feelings, decisions, and so on. The true self is masked by this activity, as explained in an ancient Indian parable. A coach pulled by 6 horses is driving down the road. From inside the coach, a quiet voice whispers, "Stop." The driver is amazed, having never heard this voice. Resentfully, he whips the horses faster. Again, the quiet voice from inside the coach whispers, "Stop." The driver feels even greater consternation and lashes the horses harder. But it dawns on him that he has never met the owner of the coach, and the one inside the coach must be the owner. He pulls the reins, and the coach comes to a halt. In the parable, the driver is the ego. The 6 horses are the 5 senses and the mind. Only when they come to a stop do they recognize that the soul is the master of all. In meditation, one can have the actual experience of quieting the mind so that the true self is encountered. You intuitively know that this is a special experience, although it takes time to grow into full wakefulness. Another metaphor is the light of awareness. Some people actually see an inner light, most often in meditation, but not necessarily, and it holds an attraction that draws them in. Without this attraction, the true self could never overcome the mental activity that masks it. The ego and the 5 senses demand your attention. The true self gently entices. It sounds confusing that the world's wisdom traditions make so much of silent mind. In itself, there is no virtue to silence. Psychological observations indicate that around 20% of people hear no mental voice in their heads. No one knows why this is so, or whether it indicates anything good or bad. Silence only becomes valuable when you investigate what's inside it. With expanded self-awareness, silence blossoms, so to speak. In it are embedded the core qualities of consciousness listed a few minutes ago. Creativity, intelligence, knowingness, and all the rest are your birthright. They cannot be fully suppressed, much less extinguished. Simply by being conscious, you possess them. But it takes the act of waking up to notice where they reside, at your source. Unlike every other self that can be described, the true self is pure source, pure awareness, pure being. Consciousness is using your brain to create the world you're experiencing. Your reality is limited to what you are aware of and what you experience. All humans have evolved to inhabit a species of consciousness that's infinitely rich with possibilities. But the highest evolution is to inhabit the reality that fits you perfectly. This is the ultimate healing, the state of complete wholeness. But what proves that such a possibility even exists? The world's wisdom traditions teach that only the individual can prove it to himself or herself. How? By developing self-awareness into a mindful state known as witnessing. In some writings, it has also been dubbed second attention. When you witness from a detached position, you no longer try to control the details of your life. No longer worry or struggle. That may sound like a state of total passivity, and it would be if you tried to fabricate the witness. If you really wanted to go to a certain restaurant, only to arrive and find it closed, if you wanted to win a competition only to finish out of first place, or if you are attracted to someone who has no interest in you, you could fabricate the response, "I don't care. It's out of my control." This is a forced attitude that contradicts how you actually feel. The true witness lies deep within the mind, at the source. It observes every experience from a place of calm mastery. There is no room for loss or disappointment for the following reasons. Every experience is infused with bliss at a subtle level. You experience wholeness, not the play of light and shadow. You don't have a personal stake in the world. The play of consciousness in all its modes holds your complete attention. In the simplest terms, you're the ringmaster of the circus. If the witness wasn't a natural state of the mind, none of these things would be true. They'd constitute spiritual fiction or wishful thinking. How can you personally determine if spiritual experiences are real? We have an answer that will solve this age-old question. The pull of the self. Spiritual experiences, like any other, are verified by having them. Saints and sages aren't descended from a separate species. They were born with the same nervous system as everyone. The reason they reached higher consciousness isn't magical. Instead, they felt an inner force one can call the pull of the self. Nothing supernatural was involved. From day to day, they chose peace over strife, awareness over denial, love over non-love. These qualities are appealing. They pull at everyone. But other forces also pull at us. Modern society has so much stress and rush, relieved by endless distractions, that a consciousness-based lifestyle seems out of joint. Going on a meditation retreat shows a stark contrast to all this hustle and bustle. But when you come home, the pull of everyday life is inescapable. Look at yourself today. How much time will you expend on the duties and demands of work and family? How tired will rushing around make you feel? How much will you long for a distraction to take your mind off everything? In practical terms, this is what the pull of normal life means. The mind is filled with the noise of constant activity, just to keep up with everything. By itself, a meditation session isn't enough to counter the pull away from inner silence and self-awareness. In the world's wisdom traditions, such an obstacle was fully recognized. It really doesn't matter if someone lived in ancient India at the time of the Buddha, or today in the middle of a noisy city, restless minds have always existed. The solution has always been managing the pull of the self. When you attune yourself to this inner magnetism, as it were, you can maintain your inspiration to grow and evolve over years, decades, and a lifetime. The pull of the self means reorienting your attention away from external situations. But that doesn't imply that you ignore the outside world or resist it either. To ignore is a form of denial. To resist only strengthens the hold of what you are trying to push away. Instead, what we're talking about is a new relationship between two worlds, the one in here and the one out there. Think of this relationship as a sliding scale with two endpoints. At one endpoint, the pull of the outer world totally dominates. Life will then have certain inevitable qualities as follows. Feeling unsafe and insecure, constantly vigilant to protect yourself from the next threat from outside. A sense of insignificance in the face of titanic natural forces. Pressure to protect yourself by conforming to social norms and behavior. A constant need for outward pleasures, since only they can stimulate a sense of enjoyment from life. Fear of disease, aging, and death. Since most people don't actually function at this extreme, all of this may sound far removed from daily experience. And yet, somewhere along the sliding scale, we experience degrees of anxiety and stress, and often feel overwhelmed by the insecurity that comes from being very small in a very big, empty universe. The pull of the outside world induces us to put physical reality first, and life becomes a struggle to find security and happiness under the threat that everything could collapse at any moment. There are ways to mask our insecurity, like the rush of thrill-seeking, the hypnosis of entertainment, and the drive to succeed. But by turning to the outside world for these things, we only tighten its grip on our attention. At the opposite endpoint, the pull of the self is total surrender. Life will then have the qualities of full enlightenment as follows. Being centered and quiet inside is a constant state that cannot be shaken by external circumstances. This leads to a sense of complete security. One's own awareness provides the joy and fulfillment that life is meant to bring. Change is no longer threatening because you see yourself as the still point in a turning world. Experience passes through you without altering your state of being. You live in the eternal now, which makes aging and death irrelevant. They have dropped away as part of the illusion of change. By living from your source, your true self, you are always in touch with the source of creativity and renewed possibilities. You have no conflicts within yourself or with other people, because the wholeness of pure consciousness eradicates the play of opposites, including the play of light versus darkness, good versus evil. This extreme may sound remote to the point of being otherworldly. But any experience that draws your attention in this direction has been caused by the pull of the self. If you pay attention, there are many moments when you feel safe and secure. Life looks beautiful. The mind is quiet and calm. You feel free of regret and worries. The past brings no bad memories. You find it easy to accept and appreciate your life and the people in it. An inner joy bubbles up, or you feel somehow that a higher presence exists and enfolds you. Everyone values such experiences without being told to. They are satisfying in themselves. It doesn't matter if the feeling lasts 2 days or 2 minutes. The experience feels timeless. Or to be more precise, you slip out of time into another place that is simply here and now. If you want to evolve, meditation and making positive lifestyle choices are important. But evolution won't truly take hold unless you pay attention to the pull of the self. Human beings aren't robots whose wiring can be changed simply by plugging our brains into meditation, prayer, positive thinking, or the influence of wise teachers and mentors. The authors are not discounting those things. They have their valued place in the world's wisdom traditions. But the context of life is always about the pull of the outside world, which is noisy and fretful, happy one day and sad the next, full of pain and pleasure in unpredictable proportion. The pull of the self is quiet, but true, oblivious to the rise and fall of everyday situations. Finding non-change in the midst of change has long been the byword in the evolution of consciousness. The pull of the self, which you can notice every day, is the secret for making non-change a living reality. Paying attention to reality in here is how witnessing develops. The process is simple and natural. No esoteric teachings are involved. Every spiritual experience is a glimpse of the true self. First you observe it, then you embrace it, and finally, you become it. The transformation follows an effortless flow, so there is nothing to resist. For a book on healing to be complete, the true self must be held up as the goal of life. We spoke earlier about the mind's bustling activity being like servants in a great manor house. When those servants are gently dismissed, the lord and lady can enjoy the full splendor of the manor. The outside world is theirs, as is the domain of the mind. There are no more constraints, and the spirit grows bright in the enjoyment of absolute freedom. To quote the famous lines from T.S. Eliot's poem, Little Gidding, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." The place he means is inside us, where we find the essence of who we are and have always been. It is our true self, the healing self. Alzheimer's Today and Tomorrow by Rudy Tanzi. I wanted to end on a strong note of hope, touching upon healing a disease that no amount of self-care or medical science has been able to accomplish up to now. Most people approach aging with a sense of dread, despite all the improvements in our social beliefs about growing old, because of the looming shadow of Alzheimer's disease. As lifespan steadily increases, a person's health span, the years spent in good health, is often as much as a decade shorter. The threat of Alzheimer's isn't the only reason for this, because other disorders, principally cancer, are chiefly disorders of old age. But none is as feared as Alzheimer's. A 2012 public opinion poll of more than 1,200 people, conducted by the Marist Institute, revealed that 44% of respondents said that Alzheimer's was their greatest health concern versus 33% for cancer. When asked what they fear most about Alzheimer's, 68% cited being a burden on their families and loved ones, followed by fear of losing memory of their lives and loved ones, 32%. Because my professional life as a research scientist has been devoted to finding the cause and potential cure of Alzheimer's, I'd like to explain the disease in detail. Alzheimer's makes for a fascinating detective story that took a sharp and perhaps decisive turn only recently. It is hard to imagine a disease worse than Alzheimer's. We spend our entire lives, from womb to tomb, observing, learning, creating, and loving, on a journey that moves from one experience to the next. These experiences shape us as individuals and sculpt our personalities. They define how our friends and loved ones see us as unique people in their lives. The brain's neural networks record our experiences and our reactions to them as memories. Everything we see, hear, touch, taste, and smell is logically placed into context thanks to a rich tapestry of neural connections and interactions that define who we are. This same tapestry allows us to relate to the world. In fact, every quality of sight, sound, touch, taste, and smell depends upon the brain's ability to convert raw neural data into the image of a three-dimensional world. But like a merciless vandal, as we age, Alzheimer's sneaks in and insidiously begins to tear this neural tapestry apart, thread by thread, until the sufferer no longer recognizes their friends and family, who can only stand by and helplessly watch as their loved one disappears. Alzheimer's is a callous and relentless thief of the mind, brutally ripping away the victim's personhood until all is lost, leaving behind a body and spirit disconnected from the brain that brought them to life. While Alzheimer's patients in the early to middle stages may have a relatively well-preserved long-term memory, still recalling details of their wedding day, for example, their short-term memory has been devastated. As sensory information is coming into the brain with every new experience, Alzheimer's patients have difficulties placing the information into context and keeping track of it from minute to minute, or in later stages, from second to second. The result is the following set of symptoms. See the Alzheimer's Association website, www.alz.org. for further elaboration. 1. Memory problems that disrupt activities of daily living, especially short-term memory. 2. Challenges in solving problems, such as mathematical calculations in paying bills. 3. Difficulty with familiar tasks, such as playing a game or following a favorite recipe. 4. Confusion with time or place, such as seasons or months, or how to get to certain places. 5. Difficulty with reading, driving, or determining distances. 6. Trouble following or joining conversations, and frequent problems finding words. 7. Misplacing things and finding them in odd places, like car keys in the fridge. 8. Poor judgment or decision-making, such as being easily conned by telemarketers. 9. Withdrawal from usual activities, such as hobbies or following a local sports team. 10. Becoming suspicious, paranoid, or increasingly anxious or fearful about leaving home. In 1906, Dr. Alois Alzheimer, a German psychiatrist and neuropathologist, first described the disease in a 55-year-old woman patient, Auguste Deder. Deder had been admitted to a Bavarian asylum called the Irrenschloss, Castle of the Insane, suffering from what we now recognize as early-onset Alzheimer's, which strikes before age 60. In most cases, this rare form of the disease, accounting for less than 5% of cases, is caused by mutations in three different genes, those encoding for the amyloid precursor protein presenilin 1 and presenilin 2, all co-discovered in the 1980s and 1990s by my colleagues and me at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. In fact, these were the first Alzheimer's genes to be discovered. They carry over 250 different gene mutations that virtually guarantee early onset of the disease, usually well before 60 years old. We now know that Deda had a mutation in the presenilin 1 gene, the same that plagued Alice in the popular book and movie Still Alice, written by my Harvard classmate, neuroscientist Dr. Lisa Genova. In his journal, Dr. Alzheimer wrote that when he entered her room for the first time, Auguste Deda was sitting on the side of her bed, suffering from memory loss and hallucinations, which became obvious in his interview with her. Alzheimer also noted that late at night, many residents and staff were awakened by her anguished cries of, "Oh God, I have lost myself." That single description perfectly defines this horrible disease. It robs one of one's self. Presently, Alzheimer's disease is becoming increasingly and alarmingly more prevalent, reaching epidemic proportions in the United States and other developed Western countries. The epidemic has been nicknamed the Silver Tsunami. There were nearly 5.5 million Alzheimer's patients in this country in 2016. In 2017, Alzheimer's and related dementias will cost our healthcare system an estimated $259 billion, of which Medicare and Medicaid will spend an estimated $175 billion. This means that nearly one in every five Medicare dollars is already spent on Alzheimer's patients. By the age of 85, one has a 30 to 40% chance of displaying symptoms of Alzheimer's. As 71 million baby boomers head toward high-risk ages, Alzheimer's has the potential to single-handedly collapse the entire healthcare system. As a rule, all of us slow down mentally as we get older. Sometime after age 50 or 60, we might begin to have problems recalling names and words. We may also start to lose track of where we put things or experience senior moments. But just because our brain begins to slow down, this doesn't mean we need to panic. The deficits of aging are compensated for by becoming wiser, gentler, calmer. People would rest easier if they knew that having senior moments is not necessarily the beginning of Alzheimer's. Misplacing your keys is fine. That's usually just a sign of being distracted or not paying attention. But if the keys were left in your car with the engine running in the garage after getting home from doing errands, and such absent-minded events happen increasingly, there might be reason for concern about the health of your brain. However, some experts argue that the underlying cause could be the presence of small amounts of brain pathology that begin with virtually everyone after the age of 40. My colleague, Harvard neurologist Kirk Daffner, put it this way. As many of us get older, we may have a little bit of Alzheimer's. It's like having a little bit of arterial plaque around the heart, but not necessarily suffering from congestive heart failure. This may all seem scary, but the good news is that we can handle a little bit of Alzheimer's pathology in the brain without incurring dementia. We call this resilience, which brings into play the brain's ability to compensate. Dr. David Bennett, an Alzheimer's specialist at Rush University, likens it to the side streets when there's an accident on the expressway. Everything comes to a dead stop, and so you get off and meander through the side streets. You can still get to your destination. The journey will take longer, but you get there. Bennett also takes note of some people who tolerate the Alzheimer's pathology observed by brain imaging, managing to avoid symptoms of cognitive impairment and dementia. Such people often have a purpose in life, conscientiousness, social networks, stimulating activities. All these things seem to be protective in terms of how your brain expresses whatever pathology it's accumulating. Further understanding the basis of brain resilience to Alzheimer's despite the presence of Alzheimer's damage requires some understanding of the exact pathology that defines this disease. The trilogy of Alzheimer's pathology includes the following. 1. Senile plaques, which are large clumps of sticky material called beta amyloid that deposit around nerve cells in the brain. 2. Tangles, which are twisted filaments that form inside of nerve cells and kill them. 3. Neuroinflammation, a response of the brain's immune system to the plaques, tangles, and dying nerve cells. While intended to help as part of the immune system's healing response, this inflammation winds up killing many more nerve cells by friendly fire. For decades, we didn't know how these three pathologies link to one another. Which causes which, or which comes first? This mystery was largely due to early attempts to recreate Alzheimer's disease pathology and symptoms in mice. Researchers took a human gene mutation that causes early onset Alzheimer's to run in families and inserted it into the mice's genome. The mice got brain plaque, but no tangles. This led to 20 years of fiery debate as to whether plaques cause tangles. All those first Alzheimer's genes discovered by me and others indicated that Alzheimer's started with plaques leading to tangles. Yet, this could not be proved in mouse models of the disease. The debate raged on. Did amyloid plaque actually cause Alzheimer's? The familial Alzheimer's genes all pointed to yes, while the mouse studies said no. The implications for treating and preventing the disease were enormous. I previously wrote about this in my 2001 book, Decoding Darkness, The Search for the Genetic Cause of Alzheimer's Disease. At the time, the argument was anything but resolved. Since then, much more has been learned. I held that we cannot just trust results from Alzheimer's mouse models. Humans are not 150-pound mice. Then in 2014, my Harvard colleague, Do-Yeon Kim, and I decided to settle the issue once and for all. We invented what a New York Times headline would dub Alzheimer's in a dish, which involved working out a stem cell technology to grow mini human brain organoids, an artificially grown mass of cells or tissues, in mini human brain dishes. Beforehand, we placed early onset Alzheimer's gene mutations into the artificial brain tissue. Miraculously, the mini brains in the dish formed actual senile plaques for the first time ever, and in only 6 weeks. More important, with regard to the ongoing